Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, what's happening, CC? They still call it the White House, but that's a temporary condition, too. Can you dig it, CC? To each his reach, and if I don't cop, it ain't mine to have. But I'll be reaching for you, because I love you, CC. Right on. There's a lot of chocolate cities around. We've got Newark, we've got Gary. Somebody told me we got L.A. And we're working on Atlanta. You're the capital.
Daddy knows
ya. Get down.
Daddy knows ya.
Moving in over.
Daddy knows ya.
Can't you feel my breath?
Daddy knows ya.
All up around your neck. Hey, CC. They say you jive and game and can't be changed. But on the positive side, you're my piece of the rock and I love you, CC. Can you dig it? Hey, we didn't get our 40 acres and a mule, but we did get you, CC. Yeah. Gaining on ya. Moving in around ya. God bless CC and his vanilla suburbs. What's happening, blood? What's happening, black? What's up, black? Blood even. Yeah, just funnin'. Getting down. A blood to blood, a players to ladies. The last percentage count was 80. You don't need the bullet when you got the ballot. Are you up for the downstroke, CC? Chocolate City. Are you with me out there? And when they come to march on you, tell them to make sure they got their James Brown pass. And don't be surprised if Ali is in the White House. And Reverend Ike, Secretary of the Treasury. Richard Pryor, Minister of Education. Stevie Wonder, Secretary of Fine Arts. And Miss Aretha Franklin, the First Lady. Are you out there, CC? A chocolate city is no dream. It's my piece of the rock. And I dig you, CC. God bless Chocolate City and its vanilla suburbs. Can y'all get to that? Season in. In your stuff. Can't get enough. Be more fun. Be more fun. And we funky too. Right on, Chocolate City. Yeah, get deep. Real deep. We just got New York, I'm told.
We coming. And people in general, we coming.
You're my leader.
We coming.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Dry Bones Connection on Thursday night. This is Antoinette, and tonight we are awaiting our guest, best-selling author, Pulitzer-nominated journalist Patrice Gaines. Patrice Gaines was on Dateline and NBC. She was a reporter at the Washington Post for 16 years. She's a justice advocate, an abolitionist who believes crime can be reduced without depending on mass incarceration of human beings. She is her own author of her own autobiography, Laughing in the Dark. She also appeared on Oprah Winfrey's show, and she is one of the authors of Say Their Names, a book that is to be released on October the 5th, 2021, which is next weekend. It's great, y'all. Honestly and truly, just from what I'm reading of it, I have a copy of the book, and it is truly great. So Miss Gaines is going to tell, she's going to tell what brought her to where she is today, how she overcame being a heroin addict that landed her in jail at a young age of 21. So while we are waiting for her, if anyone has anything that they would like to say before we if anyone has anything they would like to say while we're waiting, I'll be happy to open up your lines. And you know to press the number one, and the call-in number is area code 626-3504 and 515-605-9343. Again, that's 515-605-9343. And press the number one, and I will be happy to open up your line. If not, then we can play another song while we're waiting for her.
Sudden smell of burning. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm
tonight, without further ado, we have our special guest, best-selling author, Miss Patricia Gaines. And Miss Gaines is going to tell us about the book that she is one of the authors in, Say Their Names. And again, I have to tell y'all, it's a fascinating book.
And it's really hard.
So, Miss Patricia, welcome to Dry Bones Connection. And this is Antoinette. And thank you for coming and being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so honored. I was reading the chapter that you wrote on locking up Black lives. It was something that I seen in there that you have wrote that just took it. It took me back, where you talked about George Wallace and the code that they used. Law and order.
Law and order, yes.
And how that was code words. And I remember when George Wallace was running in the presidential election. And I remember saying to my mother, and I was terrified. And, you know, as soon as I seen his name, all that fear just came back over me again.
Mm.
I remember asking my mom, Mom, is he going to make us slaves?
Mm-hmm.
Because I heard that he wanted to put Black people back in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when I seen how you tied it in with him and Trump both saying law and order, and how Trump said it 90 times, and I was just like, oh, my God. You know,
absolutely. It was a code word, which I say, as I say in there, you know, when white people get scared, Black people get locked up.
Yes.
So it was like, you know, we're going to make everything, we're going to reduce crime, which means we're going to lock up Black people. Because you're afraid of them, and that's how we're going to control them. So they would just say law and order. We're going to have law and order. And yeah, Donald Trump also used that many times when he was campaigning, law and order. And it for many, I'm sure, Black people who remember like George Wallace, you know, even though those words can just trigger those memories too. The book is, you know, it's about how something seemed to have changed but haven't really, that there's this thread of racism and white supremacy that has just run through our history and traumatizes Black people in different ways at different times.
Yes. Yes, and it seems like, you know, we go even up to this day, in my opinion, it's worse than what it was in the 50s and the 60s. But, of course, I didn't live in the 50s, so, you know, I can't really speak on it. But just from, I guess just from what I'm looking at today, it's a lot worse, but maybe because we thought we were free.
And I was going to say, I think what you said is very important, because for people where what you were born into, you know, and it is good, it is always good, but that's the bad you know, which makes it, you know, the worst for you. Somebody born at another time, they can see where some things have changed, but still, you know, they can be traumatized from what they experienced. The whole point, you know, that we talk about is, because we talk in each chapter, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's policing, whether it's locking up people or politics, we talk about the people who are really on the forefront now, the visionaries, particularly the people who are Black or are working to reduce wealth and get rid of the racism that has supported these kinds of institutions. You know, it's just those people, they can see, we tried to make sure that we included, you know, their vision too, that they're doing the work, and it gives us hope, you know, to look at what they are doing.
Yeah.
And there are people, you know, I'm sure you know many of them too, who are so passionate they will fight to the last breath to change things. And so we tried to include their voices so that you can see some of the things and some of the ideas that people are working towards.
Yes, I mean, it's just getting there, you know. I have to question, will we ever get there? Will there ever be a time where Black people, because it's not just Black men that they're after, they're also after Black women, the Black child, and they start this out from, you know, when they first start school in kindergarten, you know, how many words does, you know, the Black child know how to speak, you know, to sit down and be still, you know, and they start making prison places that, you know, they already have this in place for them.
That's absolutely true. I mean, and, you know, that is a question to ask, is will it ever change? I mean, I think that fundamentally you have to change the whole foundation that this country is built on. You know, I mean, slave labor and the whole idea that some people are not worth as much as other people, and that, you know, they're folks today who even think that they may think they aren't racist but are still supporting those kinds of beliefs or institutions that are based on that kind of, you know, belief. And so we really would have to change and have to really work at changing people's beliefs. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of the young people come in, and the whole idea of, you know, the fact of just the Black Lives Movement and how it started differently than the Civil Rights Movement, started by, you know, different people, in the sense it didn't come out of the church. But at this time in history, I mean, young people can organize differently because they have resources that weren't available, such as social media, which, you know, they can use that to their advantage and say, you know, we're going to meet at the corner of such and such and such and such, you know, a certain time, and hey, hundreds of people can show up and the word can spread really fast. So I think, you know, my hope is in these young people, which is why, you know, we really have to protect them a lot, because when I write about locking up Black lives, one of the things that in, I know in my covering of criminal justice and writing about these issues for so long is the way Black children are treated, which you talked about, the fact that really they aren't treated like children, you know, where they seem to be there. People's perceptions of them are that they're adults when they're, you know, 12.
Yeah, well, younger than that. I mean, look at the children that are getting life in prison, that, you know, 6 and 7 and 8. And they're getting life in prison.
Getting handcuffed and taken out of elementary school, things like that. Yeah, so, I mean, there's enough work for all of us to do every single day.
Yes, it is. You're most definitely right about that. Now, what got you started on this road? What got you started on this path?
When I was a young woman, I used drugs myself. I began to use heroin when I was a teenager, and a boyfriend introduced me to heroin, and I started shooting drugs. And when I was 21, and I was a single mom, I got arrested and charged with possession of heroin and possession with intent to distribute. And I was fortunate that I didn't go to prison, but I went to jail and you know, waiting to go to court. And I also, when I was found guilty, became a convicted felon, which, you know, just changed everything for me, because when you have that on paper, you know, it's hard to get a job. It's hard to get housing. You're just judged. And it doesn't matter if you've served your time and you paid your restitution or if you've changed your life. I mean, years later, like when I was 60, excuse me, because I'm older than that now, but when I was 60, I got a part-time job one summer working for the Census Bureau, and I thought, oh, I'll be out and about, and I had just moved to a new area, and I thought this will help me learn the community. Well, I ended up getting fired because they found out about my record from when I was 21 years old. Now, I didn't hide it. I had it on my application, but it just took that long to process it. So you can imagine now from 21 to 60, well, that's 49 years, I was still being judged as,
criminal.
39 years, I can't do math. Yeah, as a criminal, as a convicted felon. Even though by that time I had been a reporter at the Washington Post, I had not been in any kind of trouble, you know. I had won all kinds of awards. I spoke at prisons. I taught them. I mean, just on and on. I had written books. It just didn't matter. They see that on paper, and then that's it. And, you know, we have a lot of members of our community who are in that same boat. I was fortunate because I know people that I could call and say, look, this is what happened to me. And, in fact, called a friend who at that time worked in the White House and said, wait a minute, President Obama said that this, you know, should not happen, that each case should be taken separately. And I said, well, South Carolina, I've gotten the memo. But I was fortunate I could call somebody, and that even after that I got a fellowship, a Thoris Justice Media Fellowship it's called, and that really gave me work to do. I wrote about the impact of incarceration on the Black community, and so I wouldn't have even had time to do that job because they told me that they made a mistake and I could come back. But the thing is, for me, was I was so upset because while I had the opportunity to call somebody and to be called back, I knew that there were thousands of people who didn't have that opportunity.
Right.
Who were losing jobs, you know, and couldn't get jobs and couldn't get housing and had nobody to fight for them. So that was the part that just really, really made me angry too, you know.
Yeah. Now, is that also how Black Lives Matter plays into all of this as well? You know, just with I know, outside of just of the deaths of, you know, since Trayvon Martin, but just with everything on this, you know, on the spectrum, just with everything that black people go through from mass incarceration and, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because what we talk about in this book, Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America, is the whole idea, too, that when George Floyd was killed and you saw this mass uprising all around the world, that black people knew in their hearts that they had been traumatized for so many years, that it wasn't about just George Floyd. That was just like, you know, the straw, was it the straw that broke the camel's back? But there had been so much that they had been carrying around with them. And so, yeah, Black Lives Matter had already, as you mentioned, been formed from after Trayvon Martin. So now people, these young people knew how to organize and could call together, but the momentum had already been there. And just the fact, too, that we were living through a pandemic, and so we were, many people, you know, at home, could get out in the street now. And we're watching over and over and over that horrendous video of George Floyd being murdered by the police officer. So, you know, all of that just made people come together. But we wanted to make sure folks knew that it didn't start with George Floyd.
Yeah.
You know, that in fact, it started way before, because if it hadn't, George Floyd would still be here. But there were many things, you know, many things that many traumas that black people have experienced. And so we talk about all of those things and all of the ways how it's impacted our lives in every area. Like I said, whether it's, you know, inadequate health care, inequitable health care, housing, education, you know.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And mental health. You know, I mean, when you look at the but I think just last year and the year before, maybe before that, where the man was naked. I mean, he was naked. I think that was in New York, and it was snowing and everything outside. And you know, the police threw him on the ground. I think they ended up still killing him, but the man was naked.
Yeah. Right. And then there's always the fact we have a whole chapter that is wrote about. Policing, because the fact that, you know, police do not generally receive any time for any of these killings. You know, so it has happened to us so many times.
Too many. You know, one is too many. It's, you know, too many.
Absolutely.
Yes, I mean, so just basically on the whole, where do we go? I mean, in your book on page 159, you have, can America save a black child without locking him up for 15 years when he becomes a man?
Right.
Or does America even want to?
Well, you know, one of the things that gives me hope is one of the things we did with each one of these chapters in each area, we found people who are doing the work and have been for years to give a more equitable life for black people. So in my particular case, you know, I talk to people like there's a woman named Angel Cody who says, I think what she says is that she picks how does she say? She picks locks to free people. But she's a lawyer who has managed to get so many innocent black people off of death row, and freed them, gotten them out of prison. But her and there were other people who consider themselves abolitionists who are doing a lot of work that, you know, to abolish the system and so that we can start from scratch in a way. You know, there's an abolitionist named Ruth Wilson Gilmore who does a lot of work around this and does a lot of talks that get people thinking. And it's not I guess abolitionist is the whole thinking is what always attracted me to it, and I guess I started calling myself an abolitionist. I was in a meeting with Angela Davis in New Orleans with this group called Critical Resistance. It must have been in the 80s or 90s, I don't know. But when I heard her talking about abolish the prison system, it just struck a nerve to me because I always feel like you need to try to imagine what we would call the unimaginable, but, and I put in quotes, unimaginable, if you really, really want to talk about changing something. Because if we just keep tweaking here, tweaking there, tweaking this, you know, we can see then what happens when, say, then a Donald Trump gets elected and all those little tweaks just go right out the window, you know. So I feel like we need to rethink how we treat people who have committed a crime. And even begin to that would make us think how we treat people before they even commit the crime.
Because,
you know, the people that I write about in my chapter generally are people that felt so hopeless as young people because we put them in, they're like reservations to me, urban neighborhoods where there's nothing for them, you know, and where they have to fight for their lives. And often are, you know, so poor that they don't have food to eat. They don't have clothes, you know, to wear like other children. They have to fight, you know, that like one guy told me, you know, when he was 11, I think it was, it could have been younger, somebody held him up at gunpoint to take his bike. Then he has to negotiate his way to school every day, going through different gang areas and, you know, getting robbed of his lunch money. And then he has a friend who dies in his arms who's shot by somebody else. And then and then we have all these things that you know, these young people have to go through to, you know, they get to a point in these young minds, too, where there's no hope, no way out. And so there's nothing to lose. It's everything they get feel, you know, to gain, because what they have to gain is the possibility of having a good meal, being able to help their family. Those are the things, you know, that really mean something. So I think that by beginning to think differently about, you know, and rather than looking at the end result of the prison and then tweaking that, I think we need to start way back, you know, before that and say, what would it look like if we create different lives, give people hope, and then if, in fact, a crime is committed, what can we do to not re-traumatize them? But if we need to separate them to, you know, but not to devalue them in the way re-traumatize them, because with the hope, I mean, the hope is that they would one day join society and be able to be even better than they were before. But we don't have a system that does that. And there are countries that do that, and they have less crime than we do, too. So it's not like, you know, they do it differently. So it's not like this is something that can't be done. We just have to have the will to want to do it.
Yes. I mean, so now overall, what is it exactly that you're hoping that this book, which is an excellent book, truly, I thank you for this.
What do you
hope that this will bring to us as a people and then to the nation as a whole, where hopefully Black lives can matter? Not only to us, I mean, because it has to matter to us first.
Right.
And we're having a problem. We're having a problem with Black lives mattering to us. You know, not everyone, but, you know, when, you know, the outside looking in, you know, when they look and they see what's happening to us, and, you know, some of it is by us. You know, what do we do? I mean, even though some of it is by us, but then who's bringing it into the different neighborhoods? And, you know, who's setting everyone up? And we have people with hands up, too, that want to speak to you.
Oh,
if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, I'll answer your question, but one of the things we hope that people get out of this is because there were five of us that are journalists that worked on this, and all of us have covered many of these issues, whether it was health care or whether it was policing or, you know, politics. And we've talked about, you know, all kinds of how racism has impacted all of these. But in this book, we've been able to put it all together. So it's kind of like a history book, but it's like a simplified version in the sense that we use real people to tell you about the history of what happened, you know. I didn't just talk about people being in prison. I profile four people and let them tell their stories, including a young guy who went to prison at 15 and had been out 3 weeks when I talked to him and was like 37. So letting them speak, you know. In each one of our chapters, we talk to people who don't often get asked, you know, about these issues, who, you know, have been ignored, but who have voices. We try to give them voices so that they can say they have experienced this, they know this, and let me show you. And so we try to trace, you know, like I go from slavery to Haitian, but to the first prisons and then to convict leasing, when you could basically like buy a black person and work them to death, you know, and cause you nothing. And then, you know, following that to mass incarceration. But we try to put it all together so you can see that there has never been a point in this country's history where black people have been treated equal, and where racism has not been supported by the government and institutions.
Yes. Yes,
you know, we tried to do it in a way, I mean, and this is just real, that you're not depressed at the end, because in each chapter, like I said, we talk to people who are working hard, but still they have faith and they believe and passion and have done some thinking about this that all of us haven't had an opportunity to do. And they have visions and, you know, can tell us the way out, you know. It's like these are people that are holding the light to show us the path. So,
you know, I mean, Lord, I mean, because I know when I read in the book about how, now I know her name and just escaped me, Wells, Lord, and I should know. Wells, her last name was Wells. She was one of the activists from back in the early 1900s.
Ida B.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And how when they wanted her to give up her first class seat train.
Yeah.
And you know, she refused, and you know, they still made her do it. But, you know, she sued them and won, but then, you know, they also retracted it. And, you know, and so that, I mean, so this has been a fight. I mean, and we know what Ida B. Wells, you know, she fought against the, you know, people being hung with nooses, you know, people being lynched. You know, so it's still the same story, just a different way.
Well, and that's the thing, too. This book is filled with folks that you would just, you know, be so proud to have them as ancestors. You know, I mean, they since we have been here, we have fought every step of the way. So, I mean, and there are people still doing it. And so, you know, that's the thing is, I think also is that you, hopefully people will be inspired as they read about this also. I just have to mention that in addition to me, the authors are Curtis Bunn, Michael Cotman, Nick Charles, and Keith Harrison. And all of these folks have been journalists for, you know, a number of years. And but their skills, their contact, their sense of history. But we were talking even earlier today how we all learned something that we didn't know about what we were researching as well as what our colleagues, you know, did. When I read the chapters written by my colleagues, I was like, oh, you know, I didn't know that. So they dug up some really powerful and important information.
Yes, it truly, truly is. And I appreciate the book. I truly do.
Thank you.
That's an excellent book. We have two callers with their hands up, so I'm going to let them to you, and we can come back. Okay, going in order. Area code 706. Area code 706?
Yes.
Okay, hello, Brother Kwame.
Yes, I had to unmute myself, and I just hearing, and I thank your guests. I'm bad on names, but anyway, and what I'm hearing is, you know, when you were talking about critical resistance, that was down in New Orleans. We was at that. Were you there at the big high school? It was a big school we had to rally at back in the late 80s, early 90s with critical resistance. And Angela Davis was there also. Because I dug up a picture. I was there at critical resistance because my study has been from slavery to private prisons. And the understanding is this one continuous institution that has never stopped. And the founding of this country was through that institution. So what we're now doing is like you're saying, that the interviews and the things in which Antoinette is describing, Ida B. Wells and the lynching, you know, this still goes on. It's just now they use a gun and they use the same people that patrolled the slave trade here in this country. Now they're called police. They used to be called petty rollers. And the whole institution is... In prison started in the city of Brotherly Love, where the first institution was built. But what I'm looking at is what she's asking the question is, how do we do now? Because what we've seen is that from slavery to now, we're looking at, we had an underground railroad, and then we had abolitionists that you said you're speaking in terms of yourself. But what I've looked at, Spirit has said, okay, we need an overground railroad because we're looking at there's a source greater than what we're fighting in the spiritual realm and looking at our cosmic consciousness and the things in which our ancestors knew and aligned things up with. Harriet Tubman followed the drinking gourd. We can follow the alignments of what just has been reset and this new energy that's been reset in this new era. Is giving consciousness to the people and our young people especially, and the ones yet unborn are being given the energies that are coming up in the children that we see that are being put into the what we call the school system. The thing that I'm looking to commend you on is that your fellow authors and writers have done that. It's just like Nathan McCall. When I hear your story, I think of Nathan McCall. Make me want to holler. And he did the same thing when he came out of prison. He went and worked for, I think he worked for the Washington Post, and now he teaches at Emory. So it's this cycle we're seeing, but as we continue this cycle, we're growing and we're getting a little bit more creating an environment of our own consciousness to tell our story, not to have them tell our story, but for our writers to write this story. And I commend you also with interviewing those ones coming out with the freshness of what is going on inside, because the thing that we're having is that when you're in prison, like you said, that young man at 15, and now you interviewed him at 37. But his mother, his father, if he had siblings, all of them were incarcerated mentally. And this is the challenge that we're facing, that we have generations in our communities that are suffering the incarceration or the intergenerational trauma that we looked at that came out of slavery, the same institutions. It's a generational, mm-hmm. and this is where we're needing to work at. And so these are the questions we have to begin to look at. How do we save the next seven generations? Because we are, in my hearing you saying that you were 60 at that point. So for me, I know that I have my great-grandson, which is my seventh generation, because I sat on my pawpaw's lap, who was born in 1874, and his mother mm-hmm. was not a slave, but she was a Native American. So the part for me is that how do we save the next seven generations is what we need to be working towards now, because the AI is attacking, but the DI is more powerful. Divine intelligence is more powerful than the artificial intelligence.
Well, all right. I would say you said a mouthful there. And I don't think there was anything I disagreed with. And it's funny, I know you mentioned Nathan McCall. That's a friend of mine. We worked at the Washington Post together, too, and still are friends. But when you also, when you were talking about the whole the divine intelligence and spirituality, made me think of in our chapter about religion that Nick Charles wrote about, and he wrote about the Black Church today needs to face, and I think some of that has to do with, paying attention to the spirit of the young people, to that spirituality, to that divine intelligence that they are bringing into this planet at this time, as opposed to just being religious, the institution of religion. I think that it needs to, there's some issues there that really need to be dealt with in the Black community to open up, that whether you call it religion or what, to be more supportive and more open to everybody, to loving every creation of our community. And so, we think about that in a very serious way, too, and look at some of the people who feel that what should be done in a way that we can really support the energy that these young people have and are bringing to us at this time. But there, you said a lot in the whole intergenerational trauma. I just finished writing an article about that, which if you Google, I'm sure you can find. I wrote it for NBCnews.com about what happens to trauma that is experienced, people who have loved ones who are incarcerated, and that can be a relative, but it also could mean the extended family, the community, the people who love those people. It's traumatizing, and you're right. It relates to the intergenerational trauma that people experienced in slavery, because and we just don't even know the impact that that has. But hopefully in this book, too, that connects to even some of the issues with health and then not being able to get that treated. But, this mass incarceration impacts us in so, so, so many ways. But thank the brothers for your comments.
Thank you, Brother, for writing. Yeah, and thank her for writing the book and collaborating with those ones of like mind and spirit and heart. We're the only ones that's going to free us, and we're the ones we've been waiting for. So it's our now moment to win.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we have another caller, friend of yours and mine. Erico 786.
Good evening. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Patrice. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
This is Ray.
Yep.
Thank you
how
so much
you
for on so that we could hear where she is coming from, and I think we've heard and approve. It's a wonderful thing when you can bring other artists together, other professionals together, to examine the condition in which we, you know, we as a people are facing. And it's just great. I thank you, Patrice, for that, and I thank you for your book. I haven't had an opportunity to read it as yet, but to call their names is very important. It's to call the names.
Yeah. Say their names, Brother Ray.
To those are a part of the problem, those who create the problem as well. I didn't get that. I didn't read it, so I can't say whether or not you're dealing with those who are creating our problems. But one of the things that I want to share with you in particular is the fact that all of these years that you and myself and others have been involved in trying to correct this condition we're in, we're under, that we have not organized. We've not organized as you have organized the writers for this book. We as a people have not organized ourselves as yet, as Stokely has, you know, tried to get us to do, and we still haven't done it. And it's done. Once we get the proper organizational structure among our people, that some of this craziness will stop, because it's the same people doing the same thing. They've never changed. So I just want to commend you for that, and to see if there's anything that we, those of us here who listen to this show here, who are all over the country and who are participating in communities to try to get us together to address these issues. And that's why it's so important for what you, that the people hear it and know it, that it is, it's out there, and that you, because of your expertise, and you are an expert, the journalist, are able to put together words on paper that people can understand around the world. I just want to thank you for that. And one thing that you could suggest to us, ground, what would we say, foot soldiers, to do out here now.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, what, I must admit, what, 40 years ago, who knows? But we were both doing what we do now. I was going to say, Brother Ray was out there as a foot soldier working, you know, organizing, collecting for people, trying to, you know, supply their needs, things that they needed. I mean, he's always been out there doing that. And I was writing. I think that's probably is how I met you, writing about what he was doing. So I think, you know, we all have a talent, and we need to enter into this in a way that you could say is easy for us, although we all, as I don't have to tell you, Brother Ray, we all sacrifice, and it's a challenge. When you enter into it anyway. But, you know, look at what are your strengths. It could be, you know, just that you're a good people person. People open up for you, and so you can go out there and find out people's needs. Who knows? Maybe you're better with the children. I can tell you I don't have that gift, okay? But I think that none of us can afford to not do something. We can't just sit at home and watch TV. And I don't believe also in just sending money, although if you can't get out and you can't do certain things, Lord knows we need your money, because we do live in a capitalistic society. So, you know, that is important also. But it could be having conversations even within your church and opening up new thought about that, and inviting in younger people to bring ideas that may be totally different than yours, but yet they're here now, and they're important. So I think that there's, you know, the first is to identify what is it that you can do, and really to, I think that, you know, I'm such a prayerful person. Usually if I pray, things just line up and a way will be made for you to enter to use what your talent or your gift is. So that you can help. There's so much to be done.
Yes, there is.
And I was going to say, the book doesn't come out actually to October 5th. Look, so
yes, next week.
Yeah, it comes out October 5th. You can pre-order it now, and it'll be released on October 5th.
Yes, and it's an excellent book, y'all. Y'all really want to get it. I mean, this is something that really you want to get it for yourself. You want to get it for your children, you know, nieces, nephews. I mean, it's something that you really want to get, you know, and really sit down and have a talk with your family about, you know, maybe if we can arrange reading groups to, you know, read this book together.
Mm-hmm. I would love that idea. Yeah, I love that idea, Antoinette.
Yeah, because it's something that's really vital that, you know, we truly need today. And I don't know if you're aware, but they have a list of books that they're banning. So before this book gets
mm-hmm.
banned, you know, let's get it and have it.
Yeah. I also think it'd be good. Oh, I'm sorry, babe, but I was going to say, like, kids at charter schools, high school kids could definitely read this, and colleges, Lord knows, I hope that they will read them too.
Yes. And if we can get it into, you know, the libraries.
Yeah.
You know, especially the high school and, I should even say junior high school, because junior high school children are being locked up too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is the thing when they look at these, I'm sorry, Brother, Brother Kwame, or was that Brother Ray?
I was trying to say, okay, what I was referring to, and that's a good point in getting it, but also, I don't know if she's familiar with Karen Hunter and Dr. Greg Carr and what they've started now on YouTube, but they've even made their own channel, what they call Narrative. And what they're doing is taking all of our works of all our historians, and they have created one of the largest African-American study groups in the world, because it's worldwide, this study group. And so it's this way of, when I say that we have to tell our story, and this is what they've done. And what she's
mm-hmm.
saying is being an abolitionist, but we have to understand we have to be ambitionist. We have to have the ambition to create our own cultural story and resurrection of who we are.
Mm. And Kelly, you said that was Karen Hunter and Greg. Is that what you said?
Yeah, Dr. Greg Carr. He's
okay.
chair over the African American study at Howard. And Karen Hunter she's a publicist, but she worked, I think, for the New York Times. She worked that, but she teaches at Hunter College. She teaches journalism at Hunter College.
Okay.
Greg Carr and Karen Hunter.
I knew those names. I'll look at that. I didn't know about that YouTube channel. But as we well know, it's funny, whenever you mention telling the name, I have to say I hear that song from Hamilton about who's going to tell your story. I mean, when you mention that, there's a song that says who will tell your story, which the whole idea being it's very important, you know, who gets left to tell the story, who tells it. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, which is one of the reasons we made sure that we didn't tell just the same story that's always told. I mean, ask the same people. You know, there's some names mm-hmm. that always come up. Even if it was just even some deaths, some murders by the police that always come up. Well, there are those, of course, that we mentioned. But then the person who wrote about policing tried to tell you about some that never made it to the news. You know, because we know there are many of those also. So we tried to make sure, you know, that we included the names of people that other folks would not include in the telling of their story.
Yes, because that's important. All of the stories are important. You know, everyone's story is important.
Yeah.
And Ida B. Wells that you mentioned, Antoinette, and her story and the part of EJI and what EJI picked up where she left off at, the Equal Justice mm-hmm. Initiative and the mm-hmm. museum that they opened for the 4,400 lynchings and how they're now atoning the land and then putting those people's name in a museum to be remembered. Mm-hmm. Not to be forgotten.
Yeah.
That's good.
And you know,
I mean,
I was going to say, and in the chapter on that I wrote about locking up black lives, of course, lynching was one of those kind of, you know, was a punishment that falls right in line. It was right in line with, you know, we have mass incarceration. But lynching was used in the same way, you know, to make a very public, brutal, horrendous, you know, horrific point publicly, though, you know, that we see you as not being worthy and you better not do anything. And we, you know, we want to terrorize you. I mean, because that's what happens when you lock up generations of families, too, is basically traumatizing and terrorizing them.
But it's also a form of genocide.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. But the other part is the generations that stood there and watched, and they had rallies of thousands of people would come. They would put it in the newspaper that they're getting ready to have a lynching. People would come from all around the areas and other places in order to attend a lynching. This is how popular it became for them to do what they were doing. As that way of that was their interdetainment.
Yeah.
Yep. You have to break down interdetainment for her brother Kwame.
Oh,
they're doing the same thing now. It's going to make America great again, and you know they're showing up by the thousands, and you know I'm from that civil rights movement, if you will, era. Where we said stop giving your money to the people who are oppressing you. And we have a great opportunity right now to, you know, to hold our money. Christmas, hold your money. Don't spend any money. And I think that's the only weapon we have left in this arsenal to address the issues that directly affect us. Money rules in all matters. And if we decide to do that, spend our money with each other, I think we can change one. Economic base of what's going on, it doesn't matter what they do. If we organize ourselves, put our money in our own community, spend our money with each other, and build our own communities,
exactly.
And I think that's what we're going to have to do to get out of this mess.
And that's a good point. But the other part that we look at is money. As you know, hear me always say on the show, is my own natural energy here. The energy that was done by boycotting, meaning that we do not use your service, and being able to walk all of those 300 days that they walked instead of riding that bus. And these are the parts of what we're doing. Yeah, money is a thing in which they have control over, because the thing when you're saying spending money, but how many black grocery stores, how many black all of these things that we utilize now with technology, we've even gone from even going to a store to now we just shop online. We've got to begin to look at how do we produce and manufacture those things that are sustaining to build a nation within a nation.
But that's the same as organizing. You organize your people to understand that and use the power that we have. That bus boycott in Montgomery worked because the people believed and understood, and they followed it. And now we have to do, I believe, today to get the people to understand the power of their dollar and how to use it. And did the same thing. I think we could turn a lot of these things around. These cops, we have to deal. They have to be dealt with, and organize ourselves to deal with them. And I haven't seen that done as yet. The closest of Patrice I've seen to that was the Black Family Plan. I don't know if you remember that back in the 80s and the 90s. The Black Family Plan, it came out of the Congressional Black Caucus. I think my brother Walter formulated that, which would have worked very well. Ossie Davis, who was one of those perpetrators and organizers of that Black Family Plan. And that plan will work today if we understood it and began to get it out into the minds of people. We have to do something. You know, the racism still exists. It's still as vicious as it's ever been. And now it's become, it's all national, but they're bringing help in from all over the world. And we're sitting back acting like, nothing's really happening. But it is. And we have a response. We have to do something to counter what's going on. And I think this book of yours is going to wake the people to the point where what are we going to do next? You know what I'm saying? Once they've read it, once they understand it, then they'll take the next step.
Well, I certainly hope so. It's what I have to offer. Look, each of you has something to offer, and, we offer what we can. And this is one of my offerings.
Well, I appreciate that so much from my perspective, and constantly working on trying to get it organized so that we can bring it all together and move forward as a people. We do a lot of things, so we're not trying to telegraph.
But
a lot of things being done here. Go ahead, Brother Kwame.
Right. Yeah, but what I was sharing with her, and I heard her when she began, she was saying that she got jailed, not imprisoned, for her heroin and the distribution and recovery and being able to recover a recovery program. And this is what I'm working in areas now and looking at the trauma and the environment that creates the addictions that we see rampant on the reservations and in our community. It's by design to put the mind to sleep. And that's what I meant when I said inter-detain. That means is that the media and the entertainment is to enter you and detain you from bringing out what's in you, that you were born with a purpose. We weren't born to be those roles in which we found ourselves in as young people, but it was by the environment and situations that we were put into. As she said, the young man she was dealing with got her started. Those are the things in which happen in our communities that we need to start changing the youth and start with the children, because this is where it begins in the womb nowadays. It begins even now today in these children yet unborn, the same way they did when they brought the slaves and they would take a woman and put a hook in her tongue and raise her up the mast and cut the child out and stomp it. That put fear in those unborn children that was in those women that watched that. And this is the traumatic situation that we're dealing with this media source that is bombarding our families, that sits in front of these or walk with these phones looking into a world that is not their own.
Well, thank you for doing the work you're doing, too, with the population of people who are dealing with addiction. I mean, that's some important work to do, too.
Yes. Patrice, I have a text. Someone wants to know, how do you address Black Lives Matter from the founders who are homosexuals? I'm reading the text. How do we prevent genocide with our own when we have the homosexuality in our community?
Well, I think that has to do with what you believe about homosexuality, you know. So in my own belief, there are many ways, how can I even say, there's gender and then there's sexuality. And so I don't think of anybody who identifies as being gay. I don't think of them as being any different than me. I mean, that's just my belief. I've never thought of them as being any different than me in any way other than they may sleep with someone different than I do, and that's mm-hmm. all. But I have never allowed that to make me not listen to what they're saying, because what they're saying might be able to save my life. You know, I know foolishness when I hear it, and I know truth, and I know something that, you know, as I say, could enlighten me, save me. So it did not bother me to find out. I mean, if indeed you didn't know how people identify, you know, those of us who consider ourselves close, straight, I guess we don't go around having to say, or nobody writes about us and says, "I'm too straight," you know. So I don't really think it matters. I don't think it even needed to be addressed, other than the fact that they wanted to address it so that they could say it is important for them also that those are the lives of people who have been dismissed because they are gay or identify differently as gender-wise, that those lives matter to them also. So, it's never really been an issue for me.
No,
but
I
understand that it is, you know, an issue for many people, and I think that that is something that as a community, black community, all community, I mean, the community at large has to come to grips with how it will treat each human being. But I think also the black community, I mean, has to deal with that, because it is very important in this context then that will make some people not look at Black Lives Matter. I think of it as different, although there are many, many chapters and, you know, each one is different. So I just don't think we can hold cloth that, I won't have anything to do with that, because I think two of the founders were women that identify as gay. So,
yeah. Well, I think
they've done some good work.
Yeah, I think the work that's being done is excellent. I think with everything, just with the push of how the homosexuality is being pushed on not just the black community, but you know, on the world today, you know, where that's just thrown in everyone's face. And so I think, you know, just for us as a people, that could be, you know, a concern.
I see it as a concern to people. But as I say, it's never been a concern for me. Even when I was a younger woman, I had many friends who identified as gay. And I always seem to find more in common with them than not. And one of the things I found in common with them was that we were fighting a world that did not love us because of what it believed about who we are. And so for me, to see my gay friends, even when I was younger, have to find love for themselves in spite of all that was being thrown at them, that was something that really united me with them, because I was having to find love for myself too. So I don't know. You know, it was like, for me, that was something that I really watched. I watched them deal with who they are in this society, how the society treated them, the hatred thrown at them. I watched them try to find love for themselves and what that looks like. And that helped my healing process, because I learned a lot and watching and witnessing them,
yes.
as well as I think that maybe they learned, you know, from witnessing me too.
Yes. Yes, sir. I agree with you. I think it's harder for men, you know, to accept that. But we shall see.
I think it's just a conversation we need to keep having anyway, you know, whether it's hard, whether it's not, you know.
Yeah.
There have been, as you know, since the beginning of time, there have been gay people. It's just that they have not been able to speak. They've been voiceless. We've been like, it's okay, you can be gay, but be silent, okay? Stay
yes.
over there. And I don't think that it's healthy for anybody to be silent. And I'm also afraid that when people are rendered silent, that it might stop me from this and some wisdom. Now, of course, intention to me is everything. So there's some people that need to shut up.
Okay. Yeah.
They may be saying some crazy stuff, or they may want to cause chaos, or,
yeah.
you know. But if you don't mean ill will for other people in your speaking, I don't have a problem with it. So I guess that's
yeah.
enough of that. But then, like I said, I think it's healthy that we discuss these things, because I think one of our problems has been to not discuss it, you know.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. And if we went back in history, we'd probably find a whole lot of people who we just didn't know who they really were because we didn't want to know.
Yeah, I mean, well, they stayed in the closet.
They stayed in the closet, and I don't think the closet's a healthy place. I don't know, because, you know,
no.
I just don't, yeah, I don't think it's healthy for anybody. So it's not a life I would want anyone to live.
No.
And that may mean that, you know, other people will be uncomfortable. Well, hey, we've been making up some other people uncomfortable for a long time.
Yeah, but we make them uncomfortable just by our presence.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter who we sleep with, just by our presence.
Just by our presence, you know.
Yes. Now, in your opinion, do you think that they would, that our presence upsets them because they're jealous of us, or because they can no longer subjugate us?
Well, you know, this gets kind of deep, but in a way, but I think that was the other gentleman on Kwame, or
yes.
when you talk about, because I think about, you know, the duality of our life, living the physical and the spiritual life too. So, so therefore, I think, you know, there are people who sincerely just do not want us to succeed because they believe that there's not enough for everybody, that I can't have power if you have power too, you know. They feel that they have to devalue another human being for them to feel more important or have power. And so there's that. But I think that also there is a thinking that, like, if we live in a capitalistic society, that always wants cheap labor, that always wants, you know, there's certain, it breeds greed and other, I think, negative thinking, or, you know, that would support some of the beliefs of the other folks who, you know, who devalue other humans. So, I mean, I just think that, hey, look, Antoinette, I can't even remember where we were going with all of this.
You're doing great. You are truly doing great. You bring so much enlightenment to us.
And I was going to say, it would be such a conversation. We'd all have to, like, sit around for, like, hours to really unpack all of this and all of what I believe about this. But I do believe, you know, yeah, there are plenty of people who would not want to see certain groups of people succeed at all, you know, point blank. And, you know, the people who are racist, they're just, you know. But the thing is, I think we are a country that has a system of white supremacy that supports all of these other beliefs, too.
Yeah.
You know, that, so when you mix that with capitalism and, you know, it's just, it's kind of layered.
Yeah, but, you know, I think one thing that I know that it helped me to see is that you gave what the code was to law and order.
Yeah.
And now I know that code is, okay, kill niggers. That, you know, as Wallace said, you know, okay, so every time y'all holler law and order, then I know that y'all are forming an attack on my people.
And it just comes from a place of fear. That's what I wanted to say, too, that there are a lot of people who live in fear, you know, who just, that's with what they operate from. They're afraid of, you know, everything, it seems to me. They're afraid that the person outside is watching their house to rob them, you know.
Yeah.
They're afraid that the young black kid that's standing outside, you know, is going to, you know, watch to rape their daughter or whatever. They're just afraid. There's this fear, there's that fear, you know. There's fear I'm going to lose what I have because these immigrants are coming over. There are people who are so steeped in fear, and to me, in a way, that's where spirituality comes in, too, that whether you have a spirit of fear or a spirit of faith, you know, I have no reason to fear everybody. And if I don't, me being a black woman, then, you know, I think other people, it behooves them, they need to learn also not to be so steeped in that fear, you know.
Yeah, but the things that they should fear, they don't. They promote. I mean, you know, I mean, because for me, their fear should be when one of their own gets fired from the job, the post office, you don't know if they're going to go loco.
Yeah, that's true. You've got a point there.
And when you see these grown men walking around with these trench coats and it's, you know, 80 or 90 degrees, and what do they have in them?
But the thing about fear, when you hold on to it that long, it's not rational, you know. I think that the actual emotion of fear, if it's an emotion, is to help save us, you know, help us survive. But you're not supposed to stay in that place of fear forever.
No, but they teach their children this. They teach their children this. Look what the children are doing in the schools. They're going up and they're shooting up the schools.
Right. Well, that's what I said. That's what happens when you stay steeped in fear. You can't see anything else the way it really is because you're so afraid. You know, your fear will cloud your perception of reality. So, yeah. And other people, and yeah, and your children are watching you, and so they're thinking, oh, I need to fear that also.
Yeah.
Yeah, but whatever that's worth, I just think that, you know, we are put here, one of the things to work through that fear. So there's a healthy amount, it saves you, you survive it, and you go on. You don't stay in the fear forever and ever and ever, you know. But
But, you know, we have to make a change, as, you know, Brother Ray was saying, and Brother Carmen, and you, of course, that, you know, we have to come together and make a change, and we have to make things better for us. I mean, we know that we're valuable to this country, and because if it wasn't for us, you know, there wouldn't really be anything here.
Yeah.
Because all of the inventions and everything basically came from us. And, you know, and it was because they worked us so hard, so we were making things easier for us, but they took the patents and they ran with it and put it in their things, and it, you know, credited to them.
Yeah, I was going to say we certainly built this whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're valued, but I think, you know, we need to really incorporate it into our own lives and into our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren's lives that, you know, we are a valuable people and, you know, we're not what we are portrayed on TV to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not the 70s black exploitation films. That's not our lives.
Yeah. It's so true. Well, one thing when I was writing about the locking up black lives and interviewing the people who had been to prison, one thing that stuck with me, too, is that each of them mentioned growing up how much help they got from their community. So here you have these communities, you know, that we don't support with resources, and yet there was such a sense of love for one another with this the generation that was raising, you know, these children that, like one young man, his father was on drugs, his mother had died, but the neighbors would feed him. You know, they would have talent shows and make sure that he and his brothers, you know, had a role in something. But these are things that these adults now remember and that were important enough for them to mention. So there is, you know, while we talk about there's plenty that of work that needs to be done, there's that I'm hoping that we won't lose, because we do see a lot of violence in our communities right now, too. And we know that, I mean, there's tremendous stress. There's the young people that have gone through trauma. And that's, like you say, we're not making these guns, you know, but they are getting them. And so we've got to be able also, though, to pass on that sense of look out for one another, you know, that community spirit that we did have.
Yeah, I mean, and then, you know, from what I understand, from what I've heard, that a lot of, you know, the communities where these guns are, that a lot of them are being placed there, not by our own, but by police officers and everything else, where, you know, I guess they want the crime, you know, especially during election time, election year, you know, they need that up, I guess, to get their voting, get people to vote for, you know, whoever they want in office. But, you know, they need them. So they always have this thing where they can declare war on.
Well, definitely every time administration tries to get even what they call sensible gun control, it gets voted against, right? It can't even pass that. So it makes you ask, what is the benefit of, continuing as is and keeping the guns in our community?
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
yeah.
Am I still open? Because I had to step off.
Yeah, you're still here, Brother Tommy.
Okay. But gun control, if I could speak to that, because that was the way in which, when you study the history of this country, that was the way in which they, after the indentured servant had served his time and service and he was building the community, they created that to take guns away from us because they didn't want us to be able to be equally protected. And this is part of what they're doing. And then the other part of what we're looking at is the whole thing that I came up in the era of the gangs in Chicago. And that was, they were planted through the church in the community because I remember Larry Hoover and Jeff Ford. And these were the churches that they met in were in the Catholic churches. And they were the ones supplying the guns because those were agents.
Okay, where do we go from here, y'all? Where do we go from here? You know, we have an excellent book, but where do we go? Where do we go from here?
But what she said, being an abolitionist, we have to understand what is it that we need to free us? To feel real earthly energy. That's free. To feel real earthly energy, to be connected to the earth and be able to choose and do things with our energy. That's freedom. And what we're looking at is, what is it going to take to free us? Number one, do we even know what freedom means? Because we talk about it just like we talk about spiritual. We talk
right.
about spiritual, but how many people know the rituals to keep the spirit connected? How many know the cycle that we're in right now with Jupiter, Saturn, and Pluto, and the cosmic consciousness that's going to be with us for the next 12 years and shifting the Earth consciousness and every human on the planet? This is why we're going through what we're going through, but as above, so below, in heaven as it is in Earth. We say
yeah.
these prayers, we say these things, but do we understand how to use it? That's the key.
Yeah. Well, Brother Farmy, let me ask you this. Is it going to be like for us, like the slaves when they were set free? That, you know, there's like, okay, well, what now? What do we do now?
Okay, but...
yeah,
we
really know what freedom
okay.
is. You know, I mean, if the only
right.
thing we have is what we have now, then what do we do when we're free? What actually is freedom? Do we really
right.
know what freedom
and,
is?
Right, and that's the part. Do we remember? Because we once upon a time were a free people. The people of this land, the indigenous people of this land, were free to roam and settle and travel and do and survive off of the land. They didn't have these borders and these things of government, of other folks coming in and saying how to govern. And then to take
yeah.
away the intergenerational trauma with the Native American is the post-traumatic slave syndrome that we deal with as African descended people, those that are. And so we
mm-hmm.
have this learning process that we're in. We went from Jim Crow, now we're in Jim Code. The algorithms and the artificial intelligence is the new Jim Crow. It's just into an artificial computerized way in dictating how you're going to be identified the same way they did when they created the Jim Crow laws.
Yes.
Ruhan Benjamin wrote an excellent, Race and Technology. You know, we've got to understand that they've taken this and they put it into a new form of what we call debt slavery. And this is the new slave trade. Technology, we went from bureaucrats to technocrats. The Bill Gates, the Zuckerbergs, and all of them are nothing but the grandsons of the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgans.
Well, you know, when I'm listening to you, what it makes me wonder is, or think about, is how there should be young people listening to, you know, to you, like maybe you're of my generation. So just because we've been here a long time, we have some wisdom, some experience, some things we could say. But it's like we have to always create this, almost artificially create a network, and maybe because everybody's on social media, I don't know, but maybe that's how to do it. But we have to create a way in which, you know, to pass on that information to young people. Like, I don't know that I was going to say that we're sitting out on the porches and young people are listening and talking, you know, like people used to sit out in the country and, you know, gather around and they talk. But it's unfortunate that. Mm-hmm.
And you got an excellent point. And what we call this, when I said about the Overground Railroad, the thing that I said with the Overground Railroad, we have deserts within our urban areas, and urban only means you are banned. We create oases because they're food deserts, mm-hmm. they're educational deserts. What we have to do is look, how did we learn sitting under a tree, sitting by the campfire? And coming back to the woman that gave life to what this planet is called Mother Earth. She has an energy, and when we sit under the moon and the stars and the sun, we get a download from cosmic consciousness or galactic consciousness that transfers energy to help us to reactivate and to bring about what's in the mitochondria DNA of every human is passed from you, the women, and especially the black women, because she's the mother of all humankind. And the thing that we have to begin to do is that we have to create the spaces, because when I was sharing earlier, trauma and environment are the main source of what we're dealing with. They create the trauma with fear, and they create, by disconnecting you from the environment, hurting everybody into metropolitan areas, creating smart cities and all of these things that they're doing, but they're banning you from the first internet that ever existed was nature. Nature is a community.
Yeah.
And we have to understand that we did agriculturally, what we did agriculturally made this country. Why can't we go back and do it again?
That's the organizing part of getting back. How do we organize to do those things and make sure that they happen? And that takes education from the ground up, from the child up.
What I would say we've been miseducated, as Carter G. Woodson wrote, because Du Bois and Booker T. Washington fought until Booker T. Washington died, because he said that we're self-sustaining. Use all of the services and skills that you have to build yours. That's how we got Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's how we had all these different towns that we created, because we use the skill, what we built for them, we start building for ourselves, and that's what they get upset with. They don't want the competition in this country. That is the whole challenge, is because they know that we built this for them, and if we get an opportunity, we will surpass them.
And it's time to do that, and it's time not to worry about what they think.
But the part of it is, and, you know, and I understand what you're saying, Brother Ray, and I'm with you 100% on organizing, but we got to even get us to identify, just like we were talking about gay people and straight, we've had gay and straight people through all of these eras that we've been through.
Mm-hmm.
We just now have let them, through the media, put it into a different spin, just as they're putting in vaccine and not vaccine. It's the old divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. It's the same old divide and conquer tactic. But we're smarter than that, mm-hmm. and we can do better than that. And it's time to do that. And that's why I'm really talking about it.
We have another caller with their hand up. And Ms. Patrice, I know that you have to be getting tired. She had did a show before this one, y'all. We had got our days mixed up. It was supposed to be Friday, and I scheduled it for today, so that was my error. So, Ms. Patrice, I'm going to let you address this question, and whenever you're ready to go, I appreciate the time that you've given us. So
okay, maybe after this question, then.
Okay, but thank you. I truly thank you. Area code 336.
Greetings, Sister Antoinette. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear, Sister Paris.
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you, Sister, for just inspiring this show and the other family members that are present. Thank you all for your input. Brother Kwame mentioned about Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that's why I chimed in, because that is where my people are from. They had 300 acres of land at one time there in Tulsa, Hominy, and the surrounding areas. My dad, he left when he was teen on his own. He migrated eventually to Phoenix, Arizona, and married or hooked up with my mom from Texas. But the point being is, it's on his obituary. When he was 16, there's a company called Allied Construction. At 16, my dad was one of the foremans. He had older men working for him. That's how brilliant my dad was with building, just like Brother Kwame said. On the reservation, these young girls on the Crow Reservation was on Oprah talking about the straw bale houses and so on and so forth. All of this you can research. My dad built those stucco straw bale houses there in Phoenix, Arizona. And when I was privileged to go to Lane Deer, Montana, I went on the day of the college grounds where they had a prototype of the straw bale houses. I couldn't believe it. I have it on film. That's the same method that my dad used to build all of the property that we own before I came to the planet. And when I was a little girl, I saw this. And Brother Kwame is on point. I believe that those dear ones are intimidated by the knowledges that the pupil of the eye, and within the Baha'i faith, we're called the pupil of the eye.
Yes, Sister
Melanated, Melanated people.
Yes.
Yes.
Excuse me, Sister Ferris, do you have a question? Do you have a question for
The question, oh, I apologize. Brother Kwame just struck something. I do. I would like for your guest, the sister, to have a reasoning with Brother Kwame about the Overground Railroad come together with the information that you're both working on, because just like you asked, where do we go from here? We go back to the Overground Railroad. We go back to the oasis. We go back to nature. We get out of the buildings. We get out of the concrete jungle, and we start to teach from Mother Nature. Are we ready to really move forth with doing that, family? That's my question. Are we ready? Can we subject ourselves to going back to the basic, back to nature? That's my question. Thank us, Sister Antoinette. Thank us.
Thank you, Sister Ferris.
Well, I was going to say, I was enjoying also learning about her father and the history in her family. Boy, that was interesting too. There's so much we don't know.
Yes.
And it almost made me, you know, just this conversation too about land almost makes me want to weep, because to think about all the land we have lost in all so many ways or had stolen, it's just, you know, it's just mind blowing.
Yes.
But all I could say is, as far as being ready, I think that everybody, there's never going to be a time when everybody's ready.
Yeah.
So those who are ready, you know, have to, I wouldn't even say get on board the train, but have to start it up and, you know, and drive it. And those who are ready will get on board, and those who aren't, hopefully, will at least move from one place to a better place, you know.
Yeah.
They will be moved.
And what she's talking about with the Overground Railroad, if I may, and next weekend we're having at Tuskegee, Alabama, we're having a festival of art and creativity. And what we're doing is showing models of how to build A-frame houses, but also how to farm and how to harvest. And this is what she was a professor, now she's retired. She owns 47 acres. There's a young man that I talked to who used to live in Philadelphia. He sold all of the things that he had and left his apartment, and he works in media, so he can still do his work by Wi-Fi. And he has gathered up six other farmers that own land. And what they're doing now is what we call Mbutu. they're working not for with money, they're working for services and helping each other to make their farms more productive between the six of the families that own at least, the least of the land is five and the most of the land is 47 acres. And what we're doing with this, as same thing that the Georgia Tech Initiative did here, 19 families got together and bought 97 acres down in South Georgia. We can do this. Mm. It's being able to see everybody's not going to leave the urban area. But we're going to have to begin to create the oases and spaces where people can come and begin to teach and show how we can survive. Yeah, we talk about guns, but the first thing that we did with the 19 families was gun safety and survival tactics, because we've got to look at when things shut down, are we going to line up and go to concentration camp, or are we going to come back to what we know how to work with?
Yeah,
that's pretty powerful. I was going to say, if it's all right after the show, Brother Kwame, if I could get your contact info, I'd like to know more about that. And this is totally kind of different in a way, but I've written about just black farmers and, you know, some of the history, some of the things they've gone through and are going through now, all over the country even, but a lot in the South. But I was even recently talking to a black woman farmer in Arizona who's having to go through a lawsuit against the government. But, you know, just it's all about that land, and we know that's...
Sister Antoinette, you can send her my information.
Yeah, I'll do that, Brother Kwame. I'll make sure that she gets it.
All right.
Yes, I'll make sure you get it. I'll text it to you.
All righty, then, Sister Antoinette, if I could.
Yes, ma'am.
I would like to say good night, or, you know.
Good night. We hate to see you go, but we understand.
Yes, I've enjoyed it. It's been like being in family. I heard different references to family. It definitely feels like family.
Yes.
So I have enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. We truly enjoyed you. And you
right.
have a special place in my heart because you have my relative's book.
That's right. And I meant to send you the picture, and I haven't done it yet. I have to do that so you can see the books I do have.
Oh, thank you. Now, do you have time to see what's going on her street?
Time to what? I'm sorry. Can you hear
what's
me?
Going on her street? My daughter had went past there, and she told me, she said, Mom, it's terrible. She was really upset, you know, and didn't the same.
You know what? I haven't been there in so long. In fact, well, I'm going to D.C. next week for a book signing, but I don't know that I'll even be able to make it over there on Nanny Helen Burroughs, so I'll have to ask about that. There was a lot of construction and stuff at one point, and
well, she said the crime, you know, just from, you know, just from what
yeah.
she was near that the crime being, and she
yeah.
was, you know, she was upset by it. You know, she's like, Mom, you know, you're going to be so mad. I hate to tell you this.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that too.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
because yeah, that definitely doesn't that. Represent her.
Yeah, so
well,
I want to get a signed copy since you, if she can, we get in contact, then I can order my book directly from her and send her the money, and then that way Amazon don't get that extra.
Yeah. I want a signed copy. I don't have a signed copy, but I appreciate the copy that I have.
Well, or I was going to say, or find your black-owned bookstore and from them, because I don't really have any copies myself. It's shameful, but I don't. I have what they gave me, which isn't a lot when
yeah.
you come from a large family. So, but, you know, I would say order it from a black-owned bookstore.
Yeah.
And you can even see if they'll send it, and I'll sign it and send it back, or we can arrange something.
Yeah, it's an excellent book, y'all. It truly, truly is an excellent book. I'm telling you, I'm enjoying it, and I'm learning so much in it.
And it's funny, say their names, how Black Lives Came to Matter in America. And I have to say, every time I say that, I always kind of, there's a part of me that goes, do they matter really? But anyway, that was the title it was given, and so we went with it. But it's a good book, guys.
Yeah, it is a good book, but we have to make it matter to us. You know, we can matter to us, and we can make changes to protect us.
Yeah.
And to, you know, uplift us and to, you know, to continue to grow.
This is true.
Yeah, because, you know, we didn't bear children for them to be waste. You know, our children are not waste. They're not meant to be slaves in their cells and in their prisons. You know, we have children that are intelligent, bright, young, and they are the future. If they weren't the future, then they wouldn't be trying to kill them off, and they wouldn't be trying to incarcerate them. So there's something that they know that's in us, that's in our children, that they want, and they want to stop, but we're not going to let them stop. You know, we're going to inspire.
There's been saying a lot of our potential and wealth is locked up, locked away.
Yeah.
You know, stripped of their names and put in, as I say, boxes. But thank you, guys. I am going to say, how much longer are you on, Antoinette?
Well, we have 2 minutes left in this live program, and then we have an hour overtime.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to bow out right now, guys, and I've enjoyed it so much.
I thank you. And, you know, of course, you're welcome to come back at any time, and please do so, especially once the book gets out and, you know, you start to get all your reviews and everything. You know, please come back, and, you know, when you go to work on anything else, you know, because I know you're going to be busy.
Yeah, well, keep in touch. Let me know.
Okay, well, we're here. I'm here, you know, so whenever you're ready. So I'd like to thank you, and we'd like to thank Ms. Patrice Gaines for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Patrice. Good night.
Thank you, brother.
Okay, and I will send you Brother Kwame's information.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Have a good evening.
You too.
Okay, gentlemen. Okay, y'all
well,
still with me?
We're still here, you know, and thank you for however Creator was able to make you two come together is very important that we had this discussion because now it's archived. And these are the things in which we're needing to be able to leave these communications that we have that others can be able to listen to it when they search and discover, you know, these archives that are going to be recorded and left, that are recorded, and they're going to be left. So it's good that you're doing this, Ms. Kim,